content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first article today is entitled, The Problem with Abe Lincoln's Face, written by James Lundberg. Looking at a picture of Abraham Lincoln in October of 1860, the 11-year-old Grace Bedell claimed to have solved the problem of Lincoln's face and wrote him a letter to tell him about it. The presidential candidate was well aware of the problem. As he came into public view in 1860, jokes about Lincoln's appearance abounded. A popular anti-Lincoln song imagined his supporters begging not to have his picture shown. Bedell of Westfield, New York, offered a solution. Lincoln should grow a beard. If you let your whiskers grow, she wrote, you would look a great deal better, for your face is so thin. Bedell's observation was shaped by a medium that wasn't all that much older than she was. Photography had come to America scarcely 2 decades earlier, and in that short span of time, it had transformed people's sense of themselves, their relation to society, and the practice of politics. When Frederick Douglass called the Age of Pictures, began in 1839, what Frederick Douglass called the Age of Pictures began in 1839, when the Frenchman Louis Daguerre's photographic process, the daguerreotype, came to the United States. Americans were fascinated by the new technology, above all as a medium for portraiture. It was the dawning age of for the first person singular, as Ralph Waldo Emerson called it, and people wanted pictures of themselves. The market answered. The studios opened in towns and cities across the country, and the technology evolved. People sat for portraits in droves. What a vast branch of commerce this business of sun picturing has grown, Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr. wrote in The Atlantic. Not everyone enjoyed the sun picturing right away. Those having their likeness taken for the first time did so with some combination of wonder and trepidation. Posing before the camera, early sitters said they felt drafts of air on their face or tingling in their cheeks. The process was orchestrated by a camera operator under a blanket, whom Holmes described in another article as a chemical-wielding skeleton shape of about a man's height, its head covered with a black veil. The experience seemed to partake of the occult, and the results, often ghostly because of the long exposure times required, only strengthen such feelings. These early sitters weren't entirely wrong. There was no sorcery involved, but something was happening to them in front of the camera, becoming an image, reckoning with an entirely new form of self-presentation, introduced an intense awareness not just of the self, but of the face. Here, Holmes wrote of the photographed face, is the nest that feeble fowl, self-consciousness, whose brood strays at large over all the features. The flip side of self-awareness was scrutiny. People weren't just looking at themselves. They were also looking at others, especially as technological advancements increased the circulation of photographs. Whereas the daguerreotype produced a one-off image, printing photographs on paper from negatives extended the reach of images infinitely beyond the original, and improved printing techniques helped put ever more inked engravings of photographs in popular publications. Photographs and photographic images were everywhere, and by 1860, even an 11-year-old knew instinctively how to look. Confronting this new reality, you just might feel your cheeks tingle, and you just might grow a beard. As it happens, the return of facial hair to Western societies correlates with the advent of photography. Beards can be highly photogenic, defining and framing the lines of the face for the camera. If that was true as of as one of the earliest reflections on photography said, that in this new age, everyone must become their own caricaturist. The beard was not a bad prop. In Lincoln's case, the iconic bearded visage is so indelibly stamped in our minds that it seems to befit the leader who endured the breakup of the Union, the death of his third son, and all the horrors of the Civil War. The figure who fought to end slavery and who, in the stirring Old Testament strains of his second inaugural address, uttered the most haunting words ever said by an American president. But Lincoln's venerable bearded face was first and foremost a product of the anxious new realities of the photographic age. All of the private imperatives to look good were only magnified for public figures, more so for a public figure not known to be terribly good-looking. One image helped fight the idea that Lincoln was irredeemably unattractive. When he visited New York in February of 1860 to deliver at the Cooper Union the most important speech of his life to date, Lincoln also went to Matthew Brady's studio for a portrait. The resulting photograph, by Brady's own account, procured with much difficulty and extensive stagecraft, helped create a favorable public image of Lincoln. Standing at three-quarter length, hand resting on two books, Lincoln appeared not awkward and gangly, but commanding and dignified. In the coming months, the image circulated in different formats and engraved variations. Grace Bedell was likely looking at a print version of the Cooper Union portrait when she wrote to Lincoln. Looking at it now, you can see her point. In that image, as in others from 1860, Lincoln's prominent cheekbones made the cheeks appear hollow to the point of gauntness, exactly as Bedell said. Others came to the same conclusion. 3 days before Bedell wrote her letter, a group of, quote, true Republicans, end quote, writing from New York City, tendered the same suggestion to Lincoln. After careful consideration of the pictures of Lincoln on the buttons they were wearing, they concluded that he would look much better with a beard to bolster his face, as well as a standing collar to shorten his neck. Our candidate, they said, should be the best looking as well as the best of the rival candidates. Although Lincoln asked Bedell in his reply if a beard might not be silly, he began growing one soon after the exchange. The first patchy shoots were visible after he won the election in November of 1860. It was fully grown as he prepared to journey to Washington in February of 1861, during which he would stop and greet and embrace Bedell at a whistle stop in western New York. Lincoln had come into his face, the one that would regularly and repeatedly be seen in pictures through the Civil War and beyond. When Nathaniel Hawthorne gained an audience with Lincoln on assignment for the Atlantic in 1862, he was entranced by the real face. In the initial draft of his essay, chiefly about war matters, he described Lincoln as about the homeliest man I ever saw, yet by no means repulsive or disagreeable. Atlantic editor James T. Fields asked Hawthorne to cut the description. Consider as a portrait of a living man, Fields said later in the magazine, it would not be wise or tasteful to print. Hawthorne complied, but he didn't like it. What a terrible thing, he complained sardonically, to try to let off a little bit of truth into this miserable humbug of a world. The truth that Hawthorne wanted to express, that Lincoln's looks were redeemed by his kindness and sagacity, is visible in one of the president's last portraits. Taken by Alexander Gardner in February of 1865, it is a close-up. Lincoln looks off to the side. You can see the strain of his presidency in every line in his face, but out of the shadows rises a slight smile. Much of the beard is gone. There is little left but a graying goatee. The same hollowness that Grace Bedell saw is there in his cheeks, deeper and more profound. After nearly 4 years of war, he'd given those depths meaning. Our second story is Why I Played the Kennedy Center by Ryan Miller. I'm nerves on nerves, fizzy, breathing through pre-show jitters. A voice crackles in the speakers backstage at the Kennedy Center. 5 minutes to showtime. Though my band, Guster, has more than 2,000 performances behind us, this one is a real humdinger. Tonight we will be accompanied by the 60-member National Symphony Orchestra, which, on its own, is emotional and exhilarating. Very few moments compare to fronting a world-class orchestra and, together, playing songs that are a part of you. There's also the venue itself, the historic Kennedy Center, which has served as a national cultural hub for more than half a century. But momentous events from beyond the stage hovered, too. In February, well after all 5,000 tickets had been sold for our two-night stand, Donald Trump dismissed multiple members of the Kennedy Center board and installed himself as the institution's chairman. The president, who said he wants programming to be less wokey, gleefully promised a golden age in arts and culture under his leadership. In the weeks that followed, everything was chaos. Long-serving staff resigned, artists canceled their appearances in protest, including the actor Issa Rae and the rock band Low Cut Connie. And every ticket buyer had a new question to answer, a fresh moral quandary. Our band, too, found ourselves on a prickly path to one of the most revered venues in the country. We asked ourselves, what was the best way to use our voices in defiance of an administration that doesn't share our values? How could we support our fans, who have sustained us for decades, and many of whom were now deeply conflicted about being in a building that was in the center of a culture war? It was a mess. Immediately after Trump's announcement, direct messages from fans began to stream in, and comment sections on our Facebook and Instagram pages swelled. Some had practical questions. Were we going to cancel the performance? While others discussed the ethics of simply attending a show at Kennedy Center in light of its freshly altered mission. Three factions coalesced. Those who thought we should cancel in solidarity with the other protesting artists, those saying we should save our protest for the stage, and a small but vocal shut-up-and-dribble contingent proclaiming that a new administration was a non-event. Not everything has to be about politics, the latter noted. Thankfully, the four of us in the band are mostly aligned politically, which is a gift when our individual personalities are often reduced to a single public entity. We immediately huddled and, though we all had our individual opinions, agreed that our voice as a band would be loudest from the Kennedy Center stage. That space was given to us by the venue's previous curators. We were united in our desire to own it. We wanted to support the staff at the Kennedy Center who were caught in this political crossfire, the fans who had bought tickets, flights, and hotel rooms, and the musicians we would be performing with. Our challenge, beyond putting on an indelible show, was to find a way to make our dissension clear with dignity and creativity. No one in the band was interested in hosting a rally on F Street, but neither could we just shut up and dribble this time. We had been given a microphone, and we intended to use it. Getting this messaging right was crucial for Guster. Touring bands that play 3.5-minute pop songs don't find themselves in their fourth decade without an incredibly strong connection to their fans. We have never had a hit song on pop radio or been fawned over by the music press. The major engine in our career, and the reason it continues to thrive, is the relationship of our four personalities with the people who listen to our music. Certainly for some, we're the guys who played their college campus in the 90s or sang that satellite song. But many of our current fans have seen us dozens, if not hundreds, of times. They refer to the other fans as their Guster fam and organize meetups before shows. Our annual festival in Portland, Maine brings 4,000 people into a community that rivals the depth of Fish fans and Deadheads. Fans have tattoos with Guster lyrics, they name their pets after characters in our songs, and use our music at weddings and funerals. As we move through artistic and personal milestones, we do so alongside many of them. Our evolving album's a soundtrack of our fans' evolving lives. It's a position we hold with deep honor and gratitude. Initially by circumstance and now by design, in the Guster universe, there is very little space between art and artist. The implication here is that many of our fans want to know that we have their backs, and we demonstrate these alliances on occasion. My bandmate Adam Gardner co-founded the environmental nonprofit Reverb, which aims to reduce reduce concert and tour footprints. And we dipped a toe into Rye activism when I wore a dress on stage in Ponte Verde, Florida, coinciding with the state's anti-drag law in 2023. But in an even more polarized world, solidarity becomes a more difficult assignment. As algorithms and politics herd us into narrower and narrower silos, the pressure increases on artists, as well as comedians, actors, and even brands, to mirror their fans' core beliefs. For some, every consumption choice is a reflection of their values. There is opportunity here to strengthen the bond we already have with our fans, but there is also significant risk in alienating those with whom we may disagree. We must also be judicious and know when to speak and when to let the music speak for itself. We had a test run straight into this volatility earlier this year. Following the presidential inauguration, we launched a 3-week tour across the United States, including several shows in red states, such as Iowa, Nebraska, and Utah. Initially, there was some unease. How would it feel to play these venues, which would almost certainly bring out audiences who were diverse in their politics? During that tour, just as now, America was raw and explosive, a powder keg. But these evenings proved transformative. Songs are time machines that, at their best, reduce and expose us. And this level of safely shared vulnerability in a room of thousands can verge on the spiritual. The knowledge that our fans could catch a glance of one another and think, oh, we're actually all in this together, offered us some assurance that our performances, even if just for a moment, actually mattered. As our Kennedy Center dates approached, the headlines stayed tumultuous. The juggernaut musical Hamilton announced it was canceling its 2026 run at the venue. Others remained steadfast. Conan O'Brien received the Mark Twain Prize at the Kennedy Center and gave a moving speech that towed the line of defiance, humor, and poignance. Twain hated bullies, he said, and he deeply, deeply empathized with the weak. The comic W. Kamau Bell, who performed at the venue shortly after Trump announced his takeover, wrote of the experience, noting it was a job to speak truth to power. And like Bell, my bandmates and I understood why other artists were continuing to cancel their performances. But he, O'Brien, and others demonstrated that there is more than one way to stand up for what you believe. On Friday night, the first of the two shows, we played an incredibly moving set, flanked by the National Symphony Orchestra. The arrangements soared. The dynamics were rich and powerful. Lyrics that would normally slip through me on autopilot were now barbed and heavy. I choked up on our new song, Maybe We're All Right. The words, the lies we tell ourselves just to fall asleep, landing like a gut punch. As the evening continued, I could sense something expectant in the room. Our fans, many wearing rainbow attire, pride pins, and T-shirts with anti-fascist slogans, were waiting for a declaration of some kind. Near the end of the show, we invited some surprise guests to the stage. My friend Michael wrote the songs for a musical called Finn, I said, reading from a statement. In the before times, they were booked to play here. But as you know, things happened, and the show is no longer being presented by the Kennedy Center. the musical whose planned tour had been canceled, told a story of self-discovery as a young shark realizes that he may, in fact, be a fish. His creators have said it can be read as reflective of the queer experience. We, as a band, have always felt connected to our queer fans, and our bond has deepened in this moment when diversity is under attack. The world we want to live in needs all kind of fish. As the new administration has made it abundantly clear, Finn's themes of inclusivity, love, and self-acceptance aren't going to be welcome in this building while they are in control, I continued. So tonight our band is here to say, our stage is your stage. We are your allies. We stand with the LGBTQ community, and we want you to sing with us. Please welcome the cast of Finn and composer Michael Kooman. They belong here. Michael and the five cast members of Finn joined us on stage to what I am certain will be among the loudest and longest ovations of our career. They accompanied us on our song, Hard Times. I'm breathing in the oxygen. I'm holding it through hard times. There were tears on stage and off. Tonight, our final night, we once again invite Michael and the Finn cast to sing, and this time to say a few words. He takes a deep breath, waits for silence, and addresses the audience with confidence and heart. Finn is a show about growing up, feeling like you don't fit in. It's a show about finding your chosen family. And, most importantly, it's a show about being yourself and standing up for what you believe in, even if it's really scary. The message itself is more important now than whenever we began to write the show. As the last notes of our encore disappear into the theater, we collectively applaud the National Symphony Orchestra and our conductor, Enrico Lopez Yanez. We turn toward the audience, huddle for a final bow, and look out at thousands of beaming faces. This is our chosen family, sharks and fishes, multicolored, vibrant, and most assuredly not welcome back at the Kennedy Center anytime soon. Ryan Miller is the lead singer and guitarist for the band Guster. And if you're not familiar with their music, I wholeheartedly recommend that you give them a listen. Today's third story is a movie review. When Young People Stop Imagining a Future by Hannah Georges. At first glance, the main character of The Teacher, the debut feature film by the Palestinian-British writer-director Farah Nabulsi, seems drawn from a familiar inspirational movie archetype. Bassem El-Salah, played by Saleh Bakri, is an English instructor at an all-boys high school, where a substantial portion of his work involves trying to motivate disaffected students. But The Teacher isn't just another paean to democratizing power of education, or the role that a single mentor can play in guiding listless teenagers towards conventional success. On top of all this, Nabulsi's film spends considerable time fleshing out why school feels like an afterthought for some of Bassem's students. The movie is set in the West Bank, where Israel's military occupation constrains the most mundane elements of Palestinian life, including what kind of future young people can imagine for themselves and their loved ones. When The Teacher begins, the soft-spoken teacher, who lives alone, is wrestling with grief on multiple fronts. Slowly, the film reveals that Bassem's teenage son died after suffering an untreated asthma attack in a military prison, where he was serving an 8-year sentence for participating in a protest, one that he'd attended with his father. The agony of his child's death and the ensuing rift in Bassem's marriage still haunts the educator, and as Bassem drives along the winding roads of the West Bank, his loneliness seems to fill the screen. So when one of his students, a bright young boy named Adam, played by Muhammad Abid Al-Rahman, loses his older brother after a confrontation with settlers, Basim finds himself naturally shifting into a paternal role. Nabulsi's film repurposes the educator-turned-father figure trope, using Basim's proximity to his student to highlight the senselessness of both characters' losses. The Teacher, which premiered in September 2023 at the Toronto International Film Festival and is now playing in select U.S. theaters, was inspired in part by the filmmaker's travels to Palestine, where her parents were born, and where, as she described in an interview, she encountered people with firsthand experience of cruel and absurd things such as home demolitions, child prisoners in military detention, settler violence, and vandalism. Though the film was shot well before the October 7th attack by Hamas and Israel's ensuing bombardments of Gaza, its themes may nonetheless feel timely to its viewers. At a moment when settler violence against Palestinians in the West Bank is rising, The Teacher, in its best stretches, captures the intimate horrors of life under harrowing circumstances, and the life-saving power of the relationships that people still manage to forge and nurture. Much of the film traces Basim's attempts to stop Adam from trying to revenge his brother's death, which, as Basim sees it, is a futile mission that would likely end with Adam dying. After everything you've been through, you still believe there'll be justice? Adam asks him in an early scene. His tone is incredulous, but the question becomes sort of a guiding principle. Some characters do, in fact, believe that things can be better, despite all evidence otherwise. When the two inadvertently become involved in a plot to secure the release of 1,000 Palestinian prisoners in exchange for one Israeli-American soldier, a plot line loosely based on the Gilad Shalit story, Basim's concern for Adam keeps the teenager from surrendering to the allure of violent resistance. Nothing will bring back their family members, and justice may never come through the courts. But The Teacher shows how Basim and Adam help each other work through the pain that once seemed insurmountable. Aside from Basim and Adam's budding kinship, the most significant relationship in the film is the bond between its Palestinian characters and the land their families have inhabited for generations. Nabulsi depicts the West Bank with romantic vision, lingering on sweeping hillside vistas and peppering vivid memories of the natural world into dialogue. After settlers raise Adam's family property, the teen is no longer able to see a future for himself in their village, especially without his brother. But growing closer to Basim gives him a window into what the West Bank was like long before he was born. Though Basim's accounts of his own family history, Adam deepens his connection to the land his brother died trying to defend, and his resolve to avoid meeting a similar fate. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you.